Welcome to the Historical Society of Pennsylvania. Thank you all for coming tonight. I want to tell you a few quick things about our speaker this evening. He has a lifelong interest in antique weapons and colonial history, and he has 30-plus years of work in the field of blindness, and he's been working as a colonial person in historic Philadelphia at the Betsy Ross House. And without further ado, I want to give you Frederick Nessner.
Thank you. Well, good evening. I'd like to thank the Keith and the people from the Pennsylvania Historic Society for inviting me to speak about my book this evening, The Fortunate Ones. And I'd like to thank those of you who have already stopped at the table and purchased a copy. I sincerely hope you will find it interesting and enjoyable. I've always had a deep and abiding interest in colonial history. I can remember this back to childhood. At age 7, the parents took my brother and I to Williamsburg on a family vacation, and just walking the streets and feeling the brick streets and the old buildings and talking to people down there, even at that young age, really caught my interest. Going in the various crafts and being able to handle some of the tools that people used, which, although they were all hand tools, were really not unlike the hand tools of more modern vintage that existed in my dad's shop. He had an extensive wood shop, which we'll briefly mention later. But I found that very interesting. And the most interesting place that we visited while we were there was the magazine and the armory. So we went in there, and after the talk that occurred there and the crowd had moved on, the person in the armory allowed me to handle a Brown Bess musket, which was like the high point of the day. That was great. I actually got to see how the lock mechanism worked, and before leaving, he gave me a lead musket ball, which immediately became a treasure. I don't think they do either of those things today. You never know about terrorists. A 7-year-old blind kid might be masquerading as one. I doubt that they would let you hold the guns. And in today's lead-conscious environment, you can't give kids lead musket balls anymore. Sometimes I give out arrowheads at the park as a substitute, but they don't seem to objected to those yet, even though they have sharp edges. They seem to be more socially acceptable. But at any rate, that left a real impression on me. And my brother and I were always interested in firearms, my brother more in shooting them, and I more in their history. So we gradually settled on antique weapons. And over the years, Dad acquired a number and restored a number of them. Toward the end of that period of time, my high school and college years, Dad decided he wanted to actually make flintlock rifles. So some of the background I put in the book comes from that period of time. You tend to want to write about things you know and understand, so the character, which you'll find in the book as the main character, Andrew Onaler, is actually patterned on a background of gunsmithing and so on, which I understood from Dad's work making flintlock rifles. I've spent, as Keith said, about 30 years in the field of blindness, here mostly in Philadelphia, some in North Jersey where I grew up. My wife Margaret and I grew up together. We knew each other as 5-year-old children. My parents met walking me to kindergarten. My mom met her mom walking me to kindergarten the first day, and became a lifelong friendship. But around college age, we took separate paths and drifted apart for 30 years and finally got back together in 2001. But in any case, the background of working in the field of blindness gave me I think a good grounding in what blind people were doing and how they were doing things. And growing up in Dad's shop allowed me to have a good feeling and understanding of the kind of tools and how the tools were used. And he also had antique tools, and we were always interested in knowing how they were used and how the craftsmen of that time actually made things. After being fortunate enough to take an early retirement offer, I started looking around for some other things to do. Technology had moved on very rapidly from the time when I was in school back in the 50s and 60s to now. In those days, the most technological things that seemed to be around were a typewriter and a tape recorder. Books were not readily available unless you had somebody read them to you. Braille did exist. Braille comes into being in usage about the 1830s and 40s with Louis Braille in France, but still, Braille books were not that easy to come by for the subjects you needed and the issues and copyright dates that you needed in school in the 50s and 60s. But I got through school anyway, and it, I think, is much easier today because of the technology. Technology has moved ahead so rapidly as a result of two major things. Technology improved for blind people and has always improved for blind people with all major wars. It's kind of a sad thing to go to war, but one of the things that comes out of military research, because they seem to have the better budgets, are various devices that spin off into commercial use, often for blind people. And the other big step was the research that came out of the NASA programs. So by the 1970s and 80s, you began to see things that would talk, computers, and then the 90s, the internet, and so on. So now there is vast amounts of material that a blind person can access. When I was in school, I couldn't have read my own book. Today, I can put it on the scanner and listen to it. So I began to realize that I could actually write a book. I had always thought that would be something I would really like to have done, but years ago never perceived that technology had reached a point that would make that feasible for me to do. But by the first decade of the 21st century, I knew that that was within grasp. The other major thing that happened about the same time was I was fortunate enough to find a part-time seasonal position as a colonial person with Historic Philadelphia. And this really opened a opportunity for me. The assignment has been in various places in the National Park. The last year I was at the Betsy Ross House courtyard, hope to go back there again. If so, if the budget holds up, this would be my sixth year with them. And it's a very, very interesting job because you meet people from all over the world, some people who have very little grasp of history and others who have a very fine knowledge of it. But having that job always led me to feel, what would it have really been like for a blind person to walk those streets and wear the clothes of that period as we do at work? Being a colonial for Historic Philadelphia allowed me to learn more about the things that were happening in the city, the things that were going on in the newspaper, to have discussions with other colonials in that time period, and really get a feeling for how people felt and what they were doing at that time prior to the revolution. I have always found the French and Indian War to be a fascinating period of our history. For me, it's more interesting than the revolution. I don't think that the revolution could have or would have happened the way it did or when it did without the French and Indian War. It had such a tremendous change on the whole character of the colonies and their relationship to Great Britain and their need to be protected or desire to be part of the empire. When Canada was no longer a threat, there was a major change in attitude. So I think the French and Indian War is a much more interesting and important time. And I think that it's one that people gloss over quickly. The whole decade or 15 years between the wars is one that when you go to school, you like bounce through that, touching on the Stamp Act and the Townshend duties and the Boston Massacre and the Tea Party, and here's the Revolution. Those things were important, but I think in retrospect, they have been cast in different shadows than they were at the time. So part of what I wanted to achieve in the book was to show more of an attitude of the loyalist side. Now, I am an American, and I'm proud to be an American in the 21st century, but had I lived at the time of the Revolution, I think I would have felt very strongly that the loyalist position was really a correct one at that time. I think a lot of PR spinning has occurred over the years because, you know, you win the war, you can rewrite the history any way you want. But the Stamp Act was not a great oppression. Somebody had to pay for the costs of defending the frontier. The Townshend duties compromised on a lot of things, but yet it was fluffed up into a major thing. The massacre was certainly no massacre. I mean, it was civil disobedience. Actually, I thought they should have shot a few more of them. The Tea Party was again civil disobedience and the destruction of private property, and yet it in retrospect have come off as these wonderful statements of independence. I think that's a really a big spin that people ought to think about and re-examine. So I've had the chance for Historic Philadelphia, where everybody wants to be a patriot, to say, no, I'll represent the British point of view. So that has been interesting. I decided when I wanted to write this book that I needed to find all the print references I could to blind people living in Philadelphia. There's almost none. After a lot of digging, I have found that there is almost nothing about blind people that actually lived or worked here. Blind people in the 18th century tended to be like the street people of the 21st century. Everybody knows they're out there. Yeah, you've seen them. They're around. You really don't know them. You probably don't know their names. You don't know what they do or did or what their story was. They're just there. And blind people tended, if they did not have a family to help them or help them get into a trade as a family trade, if they did not have a family farm to live on, they often slid down the social ladder into extreme poverty. So I've tried to represent some of that in the book, but I also did not want the book to be one of bleakness and sorrow. So I tried to focus on characters that I called the fortunate ones, because they did manage to find a way to have a good life. I, as I said, have not found much documentation for the people, so the blind characters in my book I have created. But I did not have any of them do things that I haven't personally done. The main character, as I said earlier, is a gunsmith. He loses his vision in an explosion, and he returns to his family-owned shop where he continues to work on gun stocks. I have done that. A totally blind person would not be easily able to work around the forge with red-hot iron, but you certainly can do the cold filing of metal parts, and you can work with wood and shape the stocks and so on. One of the blind characters in the book becomes apprenticed and becomes a potter. The whole method of getting into vocational opportunities at that time was focused through the apprenticeship system, of 5-7 years, depending on the craft. You apprentice to a master, and you learned the trade from him. You were kind of their slave at the beginning and did whatever needed to be done around the shop, from sweeping up to beginning to learn how the business worked. And gradually you learned the trade. By the end of your apprenticeship, you could go out and set up on your own. But most shop masters did not want to take on blind apprentices. They thought they'd be an extra chore, probably would never be able to have their own shop. Why waste your time on them? They wouldn't be productive, and the doors simply did not open. It's not to say that a few people here and there couldn't succeed, and one of the people I had succeed in that is a young orphan who becomes a potter. I know that pottery can be done. I have done work on the potter's wheel, and I thought it was very realistic to have a character do that. Another loses his vision with a splinter in his eye, but he goes on to, he doesn't lose all of his vision, but works in a sail loft sewing canvas. Not fine sewing, but heavy stitches with heavy threads. Talks about methods of threading the needle with your mouth and tongue, which are certainly much more sensitive than your fingers. So I tried to have people that really were able to make things, do things, and move ahead. The introduction of the book sets up a lot of my feeling about wanting to write it, and the preface sets up a method of stepping back in time to reach that. The other thing I wanted to find was, I thought maybe some of the military records would have details about people that lost their vision. In this very room a few years ago, I heard David Hackett Fisher, who wrote Washington's Crossing, speak about his book. And after it, I asked him if he knew of any sources that would talk about blind people that lost their vision in the Revolution and became blind. He said he couldn't think of any at that time, but that he recommended that I look through the records that John C. Dan out in Chicago had compiled from the pension records. Now, about 1818, the government made it possible for people to get a pension from their service in the Revolution, those that were still alive. And to do this, they had to write and document with statements from other people where they had served and what they had done during the Revolution. Well, and these are now available on the internet. And I thought, what a wonderful landmine here of information about blindness this is going to be. I read through over 400 pension records and found exactly two references to blindness. One, a soldier up in Connecticut got a bayonet stuck in one eye, which hurt, I'm sure. But he did not lose the vision in the other eye, and the eye healed, and he continued his service in the war. That is not always true, by the way, of major eye injuries. Often the second eye decides it's just not going to work anymore either, and doesn't. It's a medical condition called sympathetic ophthalmia, where after a major trauma to one eye, sometimes the other eye will stop working. Not in all conditions, but it does happen. But it didn't for that individual, and he was able to continue in the service. The other individual was a man named David Paddock, who served with a New York regiment, and at the Battle of Saratoga, he lost his vision when a keg of gunpowder that some other people were loading paper cartridges from exploded. When I read that, he was the only survivor of half a dozen, eight people that were working around this barrel of powder, because he was a little further away. And when that I read that it happened on October the 7th, 1777, I remember getting chills because October the 7th is my actual birthday. And I thought, oh, wow, if I ever write a book about people losing their vision in that time period, I've got to include this story. Well, that story became the main focus of the beginning of my book. I took the liberty of changing Mr. Paddock's name. I gave him a different occupation because I think he was simply a farmer at the time that had enlisted. And I moved the happening back a few years to 1764, and I changed it to Fort Pitt, which suited my book better. And historic fiction allows you to do that. So I took that opportunity, but I kept the essence of the story where this one individual was the only survivor of this explosion and lost his vision. And that really became the focus of the book. I thought that that was a good way to start the book, and I wanted to achieve a few other things with the book, but that particular scene gave me the first chapter. And after that, at that time, I hadn't really planned out all of the book, but I had to get it back to Philadelphia. And along the way, I wanted to talk about Freemasonry on the frontier, because only in very, very modern times, actually since 1983, could a blind person become a Mason. In the colonial period, if you were a Mason and lost your vision, you could remain a Mason. You were always a Mason. But if you lost your vision first and attempted to join, you would not be allowed to join. So I wanted to make that point. The Masons were extremely important on the colonial frontier. There's books by a gentleman named Hervey Allen that talk about how at a time when the long arm of the law couldn't always reach out into the extreme wilderness of the frontier, that Freemasons took care of issues that needed to be dealt with. A widow and children often received food. Someone that was being particularly evil might have met with an accident. Things were arranged. So I felt it was important to include some of that kind of history. And after I got the individual back to Philadelphia, then it seemed natural to discuss how he would have worked in his trade. And from after the first chapter, the whole book, I felt, almost wrote itself. It just kind of bubbled out. And characters appeared when I needed them. I wrapped the characters to bring it as close to history as possible with articles taken from the Philadelphia Gazette, which was a newspaper at the time, a prominent paper. They are also available online from a company called Accessible Archives. They're here in Pennsylvania. I don't understand yet why, but I couldn't make my talking computer access their records and read them to me. But I knew information was there. So I subscribed to them, and then I had a friend of mine who has similar interests that I've known for the last 40 years look up articles that I needed, and I would tell him, I want an article about a watchmaker that opened a shop in Philadelphia in the late 1760s. And he would find such an article and send it to me as an email. Then I was able to make them talk and was able to work with the newspaper from that point on. So there are many instances, as you look through the book, you'll find articles from the Philadelphia Gazette, and they are word for word taken from the original documents. I only changed one because I needed to have a watchmaker who was part of Andrew Onaler's family open a shop. So I took the original advertisement and just changed the person's name. But the whole tone of those, the word-for-word articles about the various trades, all do exist. They are documentable. Wherever I had characters that needed some particular product, I would have them go into an actual store. In many cases, if possible, I would try to find the actual historic location of that store. I found it kind of a thrilling experience to read an article about a store that might have items for sale in the 1760s, and then in the 2009 and 10 year, walk to that location and stand there and pretend that I was about to go into that store, which the whole building is different and gone. But I tried to find those places. As I said, the past several years I've made powder horns, and during the Revolution there were some 25 or 26 companies that made horn products, not always powder horns, sometimes combs or bowls or spoons or thimbles, but all out of horn. Horn was the plastic of the 18th century. It was a wonderful material to work with, and there was plenty of it, because unlike modern farmers where they cut the horns off so they don't hurt the animals or hurt the farmer, which is more likely, they cut the horns off. But in the colonial period, everybody had a cow or knew somebody with a cow, and horn was relatively plentiful and inexpensive, and it could be made into wonderful things. Well, there's a tiny street called Strawberry Alley that still exists. It's over here between 2nd and 3rd, and runs north and south from Chestnut to Market. And along that little alley, some 25 horn shops existed at one time, just before the Revolution. So it was a major industry. And I found it just a thrilling thing to find where these companies were, read their ads, and then walk on that street. Somebody said to me, well, I guess you enjoy doing that because you're not distracted by seeing that it doesn't look like that anymore. Well, I don't know. That's what your mind and imagination is for, and your inner eye. So I tried to picture what I believed would have been there. So having told you some about that, let me now just briefly introduce you to Andrew Onaler, who I feel very close to, because there's many, many things in the book that were patterned after my own life. Let us step back in time just that far, back to the 1760s. Andrew Onaler, I am Andrew Onaler, and I am a gunsmith living in Philadelphia. That may surprise some of you. There aren't that many of us that are gunsmiths, and even fewer that are blind. But I have not always been blind. I was trained in my father's gun shop at 3rd and Arch Street. Arch Street, we used to call Mulberry Street, but today it is Arch. My father came from Switzerland as a trained gunsmith in 1724 and established his shop at the corner of 3rd and Arch on the northeast corner. And we and my other members of my family grew up there. I was the only one that had enough interest in his business to apprentice with him. And in 1750, at age 14, I apprenticed with him for a 7-year period of time. By 1755, the French and Indian War had broken out. By then I was 19 years old and thought it was a great and glorious thing and wanted to go west with the army. 19-year-olds don't always have the best judgment. That's why they like them in the army. They'll do wild and crazy things, but they may not always be things you would want to do if you were 29 or 39 or older. At any rate, I went to my father one day when he was working at the anvil, hammering away on a Pennsylvania rifle barrel, and I told him that I wanted to terminate my apprenticeship, which was sort of an unheard of thing. They were really thought poorly of if you neglected an apprenticeship and walked out on it. And he didn't answer for a brief period of time. And he then put the rifle barrel he was working on in the fire and waited till it changed to the right color. And then he said, I think you're doing or wanting to do a foolish thing, and I will not hear of it. There is a war on. There are guns to be made. There's money to be made. I need you in the shop, and I'm not letting some fool of a general get you killed in the woods for nothing. So he would not let me go. But 2 years later, in 1757, in the autumn of that year, my apprenticeship was completed. I was 21. And by the spring, General Forbes was announcing that he was gathering troops in Philadelphia, and he was going to open a road and attack Fort Duquesne, which General Braddock had tried earlier and unsuccessfully. General Forbes was going to open a road through Pennsylvania and attack that fort and take it back. This did happen, and it became known as Fort Pitt. And when I went and told my father that I had planned to do this and that my apprenticeship was now over, he continued to tell me that he thought it was a foolish thing, but that if I must go, I should go as a trained gunsmith under contract to the Crown and not as a common soldier. He pointed out that if I went as a common soldier, they would own me, and I was never good at taking orders. So he convinced me that I should sign a contract, and I went to headquarters and spoke with Colonel Bouquet, who is also a Swiss gentleman who was in the British Army, and he was part of this march, and I served with the 60th Royal Americans as a gunsmith for 6 years, right through the French and Indian War. At the end of that time, the King George had established the proclamation, which did not, in October of 1763, which forbade settlement beyond that line down through the Appalachian Mountains. That was to be held as Indian land, and the colonies were not to expand into that. But when free land beckoned, people just ignored that, and they flooded over the mountains. Places like Fort Pitt, which was built on the old site of Fort Duquesne, then became one of the major frontier posts. And in 1764, Colonel Bouquet was organizing a militia to go down the Ohio River to retrieve some of the people who had been captivated by the Indians and had become part of their families. He was to bring them back as part of their treaty agreements with the Indians. We would find out as time went on that many of them liked living with the Indians and didn't wish to come back. In fact, would run away after they had come back and returned. But that's a story for another time. I was preparing some of the material at Fort Pitt, going over inventory lists and preparing some of the cartridges for the colonel to take on the expedition. I had assigned 8 men to work with the powder and the cartridges. At that period of time, a paper cartridge was made up of 3 components: the round lead musket ball, which the soldiers had cast days before, the paper, which was rolled into a tube with the ball at one end, and the powder, which was measured out and poured as a charge into the top end. These were then packed in the soldiers' cartridge boxes, and they would tear off the top of the paper, pour the powder into the gun, and then the ball, and press it all down with the ramrod and have the gun loaded. So it was necessary for the soldiers each to have cartridges. And I had this group of people making these cartridges when one of them somehow acquired a jug of whiskey and started passing it around. And when I left headquarters that evening, I wanted to check on what they were doing in the shed. It sounded like there was a party going on. And I walked around the end of the shed, and not only were they drinking, but there was some fool who was actually smoking a clay pipe. The gunpowder at those times were shipped to the forts in 100-pound barrels, and the barrels were banded with copper, so there would be no chance of sparks occurring from the copper striking on stones and the pavement or whatever. This particular barrel had been opened. I don't know how much they had already dipped out, but a lot of the powder was spilled on the ground, and the remainder was in the kegs, and the jug of whiskey was going around, and I yelled at them to put the pipe out. Instead, the soldier that had the pipe dropped it, and the barrel went up. I was the only survivor of that group, and the doctor pointed out to me in the fort that I was the fortunate one, because I was the only one to live through that explosion. Anyone else who had been closer to it died that night. I found my way back after I had healed up some to Philadelphia. I wished to continue my trade as much as I could with in my parents' shop. I was helped along the way by returning on the military wagons back to the post of Carlisle, and from there was helped by Freemasons back along the trail into Philadelphia. I returned to the shop and learned to do those part of the trade that I still could do. I worked with chisels on making stocks. I put a lot of blood into those first few stocks, but learned not to cut myself as often as time went on, and learned that I could have a life in a family-owned company. I met many other blind people as I went along the way, an individual who made powder horns, who taught me a lot about not seeing. He taught me to listen to the church bells in town because they all sounded a little different. And if you became lost, if you heard one of them, it helped give you a frame of reference where you were in the community. I met a young individual who was an orphan who did manage to acquire an apprenticeship with a brother-in-law of mine as a potter, and he did quite well over a period of time. So I met a number of people. I was sad to observe as time went on the attitudes among the people about some of the things that were happening. The passage of the Stamp Act to help fund the military and preserve it on the frontier. I had been part of the 60th Royal Americans, and I knew what that entailed and what they were doing, and did not feel that the Stamp Act was unreasonable. But as time went on, the attitudes were hardened to it. The king did withdraw his insistence on the stamps, but tried later to put a kind of a compromise of the Townshend Act in. That was ultimately withdrawn as well, and a face-saving measure of the Tea Act was done, but there was a great deal of destruction of that. There was a lot of civil disobedience over something called the Boston Massacre, and all these things were stressful because I saw them being spun into an attitude that would harden the colonies to a point where I really didn't think they should be going. And now, just before the revolution, we have reached a point where there's been situations between the British Army and local inhabitants where the people have actually been fired upon, which is very saddening and I feel will only lead to war. And I wonder and hope that Pennsylvania will survive the war also as one of the fortunate ones. Thank you. I'd be glad to try to answer any questions that anybody might have about the book, about the time period, about colonial weapons, whatever you wish, I'll try to answer it. I did not point out, by the way, that I do have a guide dog now, which some people have said to me, oh, how can you have a guide dog and be in the 18th century? There are examples and records of many dogs being used by blind individuals. The schools that train dogs, as the Seeing Eye does and so on, were only founded in 1929, but dogs have been documented as helping blind people all the way back to 79 AD. They have found drawings on the walls of Pompeii and Herculaneum of blind people being led by dogs. There are a number of 18th century paintings done by people like Gainsborough and Rembrandt of blind people being led by dogs. So it's very appropriate. The harnesses look different in that time period. And I've discussed this with the people up at Seeing Eye, and I've seen some of the old harnesses. They have some that are made up. So I know what they would have looked like. They were considerably different. I think they're better today, but people did have guide dogs. So I just wanted to add that as well. But I'd be glad to try to answer any questions you might have.
You mentioned the pension records is where you found some reports of blind people in that time period. What other sort of documents? You said there wasn't much out there, but when you did come across some sort of information about blind people in that time period, Where was
that information? Well, there's, as I said, little or none specifically about people in Philadelphia. There is a book that talks about the almshouses and the hospitals in Philadelphia for the 18th, 19th century. For the most part, if there is any comment on blindness, it's usually in reference to extreme poverty, which you would expect in the almshouses anyway, but there's very, very little information. The people that they may reference are often in their last stages of dying and come to the house and die there. Women are mostly prostitutes. Other men are mostly just beggars. There were a few minstrels that walked around, learned to play flutes or violins or something. Throughout the whole 18th century, though, it was a bleak time for somebody that couldn't see. There were many, many instances of low vision people that don't often get documented well in history. Your vision just got worse and worse, and your eyes got tired, and you got old. I mean, even people that are known, like Betsy Ross, who toward the end of her life, she hardly saw at all, probably had cataracts. We don't really know, but we know that she could no longer read her Bible. Her granddaughter had to read to her. And there are a number of people like that that would not really consider themselves blind, but they couldn't see, or not see very, very well. There is a book which is not about Philadelphia, but it deals with, it's called Reflections, which was written by a blind woman in France, and it deals with attitudes concerning blindness during the early 19th century, which weren't very much different than earlier times. She lists a few occupations in her book that would have been appropriate for blind people, one of which was a tool sharpening turner. And I thought, oh, well, finally, here's a skill that somebody was a tool sharpener. Well, I read it like three times, and I came to realize they weren't talking about the tool sharpener. They were talking about the guy who sat on the ground or stood next to the wheel and turned it and kept it moving. It was affect the motor of the wheel for the more skilled tool sharpener. There is a record in England of an individual who was a clockmaker. There is a record in England of an individual who made musical instruments. There is a low vision man who considers himself blind who said he was a road builder. A little sketchy on the details there. I suspect he had quite a bit of good vision. There are references like that. In the mid-19th century, there was an individual named James Wilson who wrote a book called The Biography of the Blind. Very dull, hard to read book, by the way, but he does list some of the things that blind people were involved in. Many cases they were as musicians, but there's very, very little actual documentary evidence of people here. I did find, which I thought was interesting, in the Gazette there are any number of articles by physicians who guarantee the return of sight, promise great things. However, they're only going to be in town for a short period of time, so you should hurry by, pay them, and they will give you some medicine to take for the cure. And you know they were going to be out of town by the time you didn't. By the time you found out it didn't work. So there's a lot of ads by charlatans that, you know, just promised everything, and people were desperate and would do what they could, I guess, if they had some money or family to help them with funding. But there were no really good cures. Schools for the blind don't come into existence till the 1830s. Overbrook School for the Blind is one of the first three in the country. The Perkins School in Boston is probably the first. The New York Institute and Perkins Overbrook, which at that time was the Philadelphia Institute for the Blind, kind of argue over who really was the first, but it comes down to, well, we know we had a class on that day which predates your, you know, little, but they were all around the 1830, 1831 period. And they all went on to be successful and models for schools that would be developed beyond that later in the 19th century in other states. The Civil War was one of the major breakthroughs for blind people, because people from the Civil War, one individual named Hinman Hall, organized workshops here in Philadelphia. And that was one of the first examples of organized trades for blind people. He tried a few different trades to see what would be feasible. He tried harness making, which didn't work out too well. He ultimately settled on broom making, which became one of the stereotypes that existed in well into the late 20th century. The shops that would make brooms and so on. That industry did flourish for blind people during the late 19th century. There were workshops that were set up. It lost a lot of financial stability, though, in the 1890s when steam power was harnessed to drive some of the machinery, and they could be made more economically by machine than by people twisting them and folding in the broom corn and wrapping wire around it by hand. So that industry died into the early 20th century. World War I had a big effect on blind people, because many blind people that lost vision in the gas attacks in France and so on were aided by the American Red Cross. Some organizations like Volunteer Services for the Blind here in Philadelphia were established as a result of that. World War II had a good effect, because it started the Veterans Administration to help blind people. But the early years, the early 18th century, there's very, very little. As I said, it's the blind people then were like the street people. You know they're out there, but you don't really know much about individual ones.
Are there any accounts of blind people who may have been born into upper class families?
Not that I found. Surely that did happen. But they, in that case, just were sort of taken care of by the family. Well into the 20th century, there are cases where people felt that to have a blind child was somehow represented past sins in their life, and it was a punishment from God. And there are, fortunately, only a few, but there are actually people who were kept locked away in basements or attics by their family, and the word was put out to the community that little so-and-so had died, because the family was ashamed to have this blind child. And there were people that have grown up in isolation, have later moved on to like mental hospitals because they had no education or background. But that was happening as late as the mid-20th century. If you were really wealthy, though, I suspect your family took care of you, got you possibly got you a tutor. I mean, there are families like Helen Keller, where her father owned a mill of some type, I think a sawmill maybe, but in any case, had the money to bring a tutor in for her, had the money and the good fortune to get her into a school. But all this happens later. You know, her life is 1880 something. So this is all later in time.
I work at a school for the blind in New York State, Western New York, and I helped put together the museum that we have there and found that the development of the dictaphone provided an occupation to many of the young women that went to the school there.
To assemble them or to do what?
To take notes from them, because they learned how to type.
Yeah, I think it was 1847, there's a patent record, I believe it was for the Reed Typewriter Company, and one of their claims was that this would be a wonderful device for blind people to be able to write, because although Louis Braille had by that time invented Braille as a writing system, you know, one blind person could write Braille to another blind person, it didn't really give them access to the print world around them. It didn't let them communicate with anyone other than, say, a teacher in a school for the blind that might have known Braille. So the typewriter was a major breakthrough, and now a blind person could sit down and type a letter that somebody else could read. And that was only in the mid-19th century. I point out in the introduction to the book that until about the time of the Civil War, you communicated with people in one of two ways. You either spoke to them directly and within their hearing, or you wrote something down, which then had to be carried or sent to them. They didn't have the internet and iPhones and, you know, all the things today that today's youth think are just absolute necessities. They didn't exist, they didn't have them, and there was little way to communicate. So the typewriter was a great benefit and breakthrough. I remember using a typewriter in school myself and thinking that the way I spell, I could never write a book, you know. But spell check has helped.
You've done so much research on both, you know, colonial blindness, even you made a reference to examples of blindness in England. Have you come across anything that dealt with, since you were dealing with colonial times, blindness in Native American communities? I wonder if their perception of it was different than...
Well, I think that the Native American perception of blindness is different. In some cases, they equate blindness with a spiritual entity that allows you to have sight beyond. In other words, to be able to predict the future. I think that people like that would have sunk into something of a female role in the tribes. I mean, not sexually, but in terms of they were not hunters and so on, they would have learned treating hides in the camp and helping with cooking and things around the lodges and teepees and shelters. I spent as an attempt to learn more about Native American feelings, I spent 16 days on a Navajo reservation, and this obviously wasn't in the 18th century, it was in the 1990s. And I tried to speak with people out there and ask if they were, you know, receiving the wonderful benefit that the federal government has made for all blind people of having books. At that time they were on tape, now they're in more of a digital format, but they were made available free, and the response that I was told over and over and over again was, why should we care about what the libraries say and read the white man's lies? They didn't want to be dependent on recorders. They didn't want to be dependent on batteries. They said, if you get me a machine like that, how would I keep it working? So I think that their attitude was kinder. I don't think that they tried to hide individuals. They worked with them. They became part of the family. As I said, they took on some female chores around the camp. And I think that in many cases, they would have been invited to work with the medicine man. They would have become part of the oral tradition, where they memorize long passages of history and life and times and things that were instructive to children. So I think in some cases they had a role of being teachers as well. I met a grandmother out there on the Navajo reservation that was 100 and some years old. She'd kind of lost track of time. She also couldn't remember which one of her, I think it was 68 or 69 grandchildren that she could think of had said they were going to come and see her again. She was mostly blind. She lived out in the middle of nowhere on this reservation. I mean, it's obvious why the government gave these people Arizona as a reservation, because there are vast sections of absolutely nothing. But she had a few sheep and had a mud dwelling called a hogan. And next to that, she lived in a kind of an old truck body trailer that one of her grandkids had dragged in for her. There was a little windmill that helped run a pump for water. And I asked her, where were you from? She only spoke Navajo, but I asked one of her granddaughters, and the granddaughter put my question to her. And after sitting there for a few seconds, the grandmother started this long, long, long tale. And the granddaughter said to me, she's essentially telling you the creation story. So when you ask where she was from, she's beginning to tell you about, you know, the great turtle who had a speck of mud on its back and so on. So I think they were teachers. They were camp laborers. They were oral historians. They probably became good at doing things that you could do by hand, like chipping out arrowheads and flint tools and things like that. But in general, I would say the Native Americans were kinder than European or North American populations to blind people. Anyone else have any thoughts or want to discuss any points? Well, if not, I will be around a little while if you think of some, but I'm pleased to have been able to speak with you and hope that I haven't bored too many people. But the 18th century is a very wonderful, wonderful, exciting time. And I try to spend as much time in it as I can. I enjoy wearing the clothes of that century. And one of the really interesting things about their clothing, I think, are the shoe buckles. They are a small part of the clothing, but they are unlike modern buckles. When you look at how they're made, it's obvious why and what they do. Yet they're not like modern buckles. And they were treated with great value at the time, because they would say that you can find any cobbler on the frontier that can cobble together a pair of shoes for you, something you can put on your feet. But you can't find just anybody that can make a pair of buckles. So consequently, when we look through old wills and so on, we'll often find that so-and-so will have left his silver buckles to his favorite nephew or son or whatever the case may be. But he didn't leave him the shoes. He left him the buckles. So that's kind of a thing. And I think by wearing the clothes, it gives one a perspective that, as the old saying is, you don't know a man till you've walked in his shoes. So I enjoy that. I've gotten my wife to participate in that as well. I think I have dragged her, not exactly kicking and screaming into the 18th century, but coaxed her there. She is the artist in the family. She did the illustrations for the book. We go to some historic events, which she's very, very good about putting up with my strange interests. Thank you.